This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, coming up on Africa News Tonight.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the United Nations says civilians are paying a high price in the conflict in the central Kasai region. A UN report out this week accuses state security forces of killing dozens of women and children.
That's VOA's William Klaus reporting from Kinshasa. Details coming up.
Also, six people were killed today in the capital of Somalia as they tried to defuse a car bomb. And the U.S. may soon revoke the temporary immigration status granted to thousands of West Africans who fled the Ebola epidemic 3 years ago.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
In Somalia, six people were killed today in the capital as they tried to defuse a car bomb. Five security personnel and a mine expert died in the blast in Mogadishu's Wadajir neighborhood. A police spokesman says it appears the bomb was detonated by remote control. No group has claimed responsibility yet, but Al-Shabaab militants are suspected.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the United Nations says civilians are paying a high price in the conflict in the central Kasai region. A UN report out this week accuses state security forces of killing dozens of women and children. For VOA in Kinshasa, William Klaus has the story.
Since August of last year, the Kasai region in central Congo has been the scene of bloody fighting between the government and an armed group known as Kamwina Nsapu. Both sides of the conflict have been condemned by the United Nations, the militants for allegedly recruiting children and attacking public buildings and officials, and the security forces for allegedly deploying disproportionate and indiscriminate force in operations against Kamwina Nsapu rebels. On Tuesday, the UN's Joint Human Rights Office published findings that the Congolese military and police force carried out at least 185 extrajudicial executions during March and April, including 16 women and 53 children, in just three towns in Kasai Central province during operations against the armed group. Kasai Central is just one of the five provinces affected by the fighting. VOA spoke with José María Arenas, the Joint Human Rights Office's director.
We are also very worried by the excessive and disproportionate use of force by state actors, particularly by military units, but also by the police, which explains the large number of extrajudicial killings and summary executions.
Arenas told VOA that up to 700 civilians may have been killed since the start of the fighting. The government has denied accusations of abuses against civilians. On Monday, military spokesman General Leon Richard Kasonga told reporters that the Congolese armed forces respect international humanitarian law and human rights and have operated in a professional manner. The UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says the crisis in the Kasai region has displaced more than 1.2 million people. Violence appears to be intensifying. The UN says 100,000 civilians were uprooted during the first week of May alone. In recent months, UN investigators say that they have also found mass graves, reportedly dug by Congolese soldiers following clashes.
Up until now, 42 of these sites have been documented and reported to the government for their action. The United Nations has offered support, both operational and technical, for verifying and conducting a credible investigation as to who is responsible for these mass graves. We are still waiting to hear from the authorities what progress has been made.
Congolese civil society activists doubt the government's capacity to carry out a credible inquiry. Jean-Claude Katende, the president of the African Association for the Defense of Human Rights, spoke to VOA. He said that the only possibility for victims to eventually get access to justice is to put in place an international inquest under the UN to investigate all these violations of human rights. General Kasonga, the military spokesman, accused Kamwina and Sapu of digging the mass graves, calling them militiamen, bloodthirsty terrorist insurgents. He said the military investigation into the mass graves is ongoing. Kasonga urged militia fighters to lay down their weapons, and in March, the Interior Ministry said that 400 had surrendered in the course of a week. William Clowes for VOA News, Kinshasa.
Health experts from the World Health Organization and the DRC continue to determine the scope of the Ebola outbreak in remote northern Congo. At least three deaths have been reported among the 20 suspected and confirmed cases in Boswale province. Some of the lessons learned in the huge West Africa outbreak a few years ago may be applied in the DRC. Penn State scientists in the U.S. led an international team that developed a new approach to gathering information on Ebola and quickly identifying the most effective ways to manage the outbreak. Penn State alumni professor of biology Katrina Shea is the lead author of the study. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua about the new study and her reaction to the DRC outbreak.
I was just horrified, of course. It's so tragic when people die from anything like this. It's a terrifying disease, and I just can't imagine the impact that it has both on the people who are ill but on the people they leave behind.
When you look at this outbreak and you've done your research into the last epidemic, what do you think would be the best approach for researchers and epidemiologists, etc., who are going to the scene?
Well, incredibly important, of course, is to trace all contacts. And then public awareness campaigns and careful funeral practices came out in our study as the two most effective management actions that could be taken to prevent further cases developing.
Now, that was extremely important. I remember, as far as the funeral practices go, that was a major cultural change for the people of West Africa, who would wash the bodies before burial.
Indeed. It's very, very difficult. I can understand that if that is how you feel, you are sending your family member on to not do something that they expected that you would do for them. I mean, I myself would find that very, very challenging. But I hope that people would understand that it's more important to safeguard the lives of those in the next generations, because the practices are very, very dangerous, because Ebola is transmitted through fluids. And so by touching and washing the body after death, when viral load is extremely high, that is an extremely, extremely dangerous thing to do for the person who handles the body, because there is a very high chance then that they will contract Ebola themselves.
Let me read a quote from you. It says, When a disease outbreak happens, there is a lot of information that you just don't know. Who will get sick? How will the disease spread? What will make things worse or better? But you still have to act. What do you mean?
So an outbreak happens, and in the case of Ebola, for example, we might not know where it started or who's been in touch with someone who's been infected. We may not know the mortality rate. We may not even know if it really is Ebola. It could be some other hemorrhagic disease which might require some other treatment. And yet, to do nothing is still an action. You can decide to do nothing, but that is still doing nothing. And mostly we want to help. And so we try to do something to make it better. But there are a lot of different possible things that one could do. And some of those will be more effective than others. And the problem is that at the beginning of an outbreak, you don't always know that. What was fascinating about the 2014-2015 Ebola outbreak was that there was a great deal of debate in the literature, in the scientific literature, and in the press about how big the outbreak was going to be. And people were making estimates from relatively small outbreaks, maybe 10,000 people, to relatively large outbreaks, well over a million in size. And because of this huge diversity of potential outcomes, there was a lot of discussion about which models were correct and so forth. What we did in our study was we took 37 of those models and recoded them to make sure we got the same answers they did. And yet what we did was ask a slightly different question. We asked not how many people will get sick, but what should we do about it? And what it turns out is that no matter what size of outbreak the model predicted, nearly all of the models agreed that two things were the best things to do. And that was to improve funeral practices and reducing community transmission. And that could be through sanitation kits, through public awareness campaigns, through self-quarantine. So if you feel you're ill, maybe stay at home until you're sure that it's not Ebola to make sure you don't pass it on to your friends or in relations.
It seems so simple to come up with two answers like that.
We looked at five main actions that people took. So this also included increasing hospitalization, reducing hospital transmission, as well as the reducing funeral transmission and transmission in the community. And it turns out that some of those actions, while they're very, very good for the individual patient, clearly you want to get to hospital, for example, while it's good for the patient, it does not stop the outbreak. It's funeral practices and improving those and reducing transmission within the general community that will really stop the outbreak in its tracks much more effectively than getting everyone to hospital.
Now, of course, in the last big outbreak when it happened, the local health services were overwhelmed. The World Health Organization was scrambling. Now that you've looked at that major epidemic, were you able to sort of narrow it down and make the next approach maybe more focused than it was during the earlier epidemic?
I believe that the approach we have put forward would indeed do that because it allows disparate scientific groups to put forward their best understanding of what's going on. And for a policymaker, instead of having to choose between them, should I trust this group or should I trust this group? They're telling me completely different things. And in fact, there's a way of synthesizing all of those different inputs to find out where there is advice that is grounded in scientific understanding, but that is common to all of the different research efforts, so that there's some confidence that this is actually an action that would be worth taking.
Penn State alumni professor of biology, Katrina Shea, she spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
The U.S. may soon revoke the temporary immigration status granted to thousands of West Africans who fled the Ebola epidemic 3 years ago. The Department of Homeland Security had granted them temporary protected status for 18 months and then extended it twice. However, since the major affected countries, Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, were declared Ebola-free last year, the protected status may be lifted.
Analysts and rights advocates are expressing concern about reports that Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir had been invited to a summit this weekend in Saudi Arabia, which U.S. President Donald Trump also expects to attend. The invitation to Bashir has stirred controversy as the Sudanese leader has been charged with war crimes by the International Criminal Court. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
The International Criminal Court considers Omar al-Bashir a fugitive from justice and has sought his arrest since 2009. Elise Kepler, an associate director at Human Rights Watch, says interactions between a U.S. president and an alleged war criminal would send what she calls a terrible signal.
Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir has been charged by the International Criminal Court with the most grave crimes under international law, for alleged responsibility for abuses in Darfur. The charges are genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. There really is nothing more serious.
Eric Reeves, senior fellow at Harvard University's FXB Center for Health and Human Rights, says Trump should boycott the event altogether.
To the extent that Bashir can travel without problem, it weakens the ICC, and so Trump is contributing to that with his presence.
Calls to Sudan's foreign minister and government spokesman for response went unanswered. David Bosco is an associate professor at Indiana University and an expert on the International Criminal Court. He says Saudi Arabia has welcomed Bashir in the past.
So this isn't a departure from Saudi policy on Bashir, but it is, of course, notable that he's being invited to a kind of summit where President Trump would be present. And U.S. officials have not met with Bashir, and they've had a policy of avoiding meeting with Bashir. And so Saudi Arabia has put the United States in a difficult position here.
Bosco adds that the Trump administration's position toward the ICC is still vague.
It is important to recognize that we're in a different world with the Trump administration regarding the ICC than we were with the Obama administration. The Obama administration, while, you know, it wasn't going to push to join the court, was fairly friendly toward it. The Trump administration, it's much less clear, you know, how friendly this administration is going to be to the court.
The United States is not a member of the ICC, but a State Department official provided a statement that the U.S. opposes invitations, facilitation, or support for travel by any person subject to outstanding ICC arrest warrants, including President Bashir. The U.S. lifted some sanctions against Sudan in January, with then-President Barack Obama citing positive actions by the Sudanese government. A State Department official said there could be a permanent revocation of sanctions in 6 months if progress continued. Since his indictment, Bashir has traveled to ICC member countries such as South Africa and Jordan, which have a legal obligation to arrest him, but so far have not. Because Saudi Arabia is not a member of the ICC, the country does not have the same obligation. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yisroel Heap, 21 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Six people were killed today in the capital of Somalia as they tried to defuse a car bomb. And the U.S. may soon revoke the temporary immigration status granted to thousands of West Africans who fled the Ebola epidemic 3 years ago. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Agriculture and climate experts are promoting mobile technology to help poor farmers scale up insurance against climate-related losses and protect their livelihoods. They say mobile phone technology streamlines the process of collecting data and allows the information to be more accessible to farmers. This, in turn, allows them to better adapt to increasingly erratic weather patterns such as flooding and droughts. Olu Ajay is the Senior Program Coordinator and Lead Specialist on Climate Change and Agriculture at the Technical Center for Agricultural and Rural Cooperation. He spoke with me about the use of mobile technology as a vital way for farmers to protect their livelihoods.
This is areas in which mobile technologies can be used to help poor farmers in the area of getting them access to information that can help them in their agricultural practices. In view of the increase in internet penetration, particularly use of mobile by farmers, and given the fact that traditional extension services has become a challenge of reaching out to farmers, opportunities to use mobiles using some ICT and platforms, getting information, and from there, downloading and sending forth information to farmers has become one of the very good options. So farmers can have access to information on their mobile phone and in different languages that they can understand in terms of how can they get some advisory services on their farm operations. That's one of the great things that can help them in livelihood activities which is tied to their farms and their farm operations.
What would be an example of how a farmer could access information?
An example is the area of climate change and the challenges that farmers have with climate change. As we all know, weather patterns highly influence agricultural practices, which in turn affect the food security, nutrition, and income of rural households and poor farmers. The high vulnerability of climate change causes recurrent swings between food scarcity and food surplus for millions of poor holder farmers. And because smallholder farmers don't have access to some of the adaptive solutions that could help them to cope with the challenges of climate change. This results in negative impact for them in their food and nutrition and income security for their household. And one of the ways in which mobile or ICT can be used is that some of these solutions and information on these solutions, climate and weather services data that can help farmers have access to the prediction on the weather. For example, when will the rain come in the next 2 days? So what time should they plant? What kind of variety of seed to plant? They can get information that can help them to know, to make an informed decision, which we know otherwise have been possible. Now they can have access to know in the next 3 days, there'll be no rain. So maybe it's not important for me to plant now. They can plant just after the rains. Those kind of information are available now, and they can be widely disseminated using mobile phones and ICT technology. Countries have maybe two or three flagship mobile telephone companies that can provide access to mobile telephone services.
So they would actually be calling a phone number and getting either a person or some type of automated...
Some recorded information, yes.
This is using the actual telephone and calling a phone number.
Yes. Or SMS, which is actually cheaper, can be disseminated, yeah.
Do the majority of farmers, they have access to mobile phones?
Yeah, a lot of farmers now have access to mobile phone because the price for the access has actually gone down drastically over the years. And also that is also complemented by the fact that they are available now to most farmers.
What places in Africa is this being used right now?
We have an example in our project in Uganda, where farmers, through their mobile phone, they are registered first. So all the information, the location, they are registered on a digital platform. And we're working with a data services provider. The information is downloaded from the satellite, are converted into very simple, clear messages, used on platforms, and these are mass disseminated, tailored specifically to the conditions of the farmers in the area, given that we already have information on the location of the farmers. This information are systematically disseminated to farmers on weather information, as well as on agronomic practices, and also in the use of crop insurance.
Olu Ajay is the Senior Program Coordinator and Lead Specialist on Climate Change and Agriculture at the Technical Center for Agricultural and Rural Cooperation. He spoke with me from the Netherlands.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, what does the future hold for Liberia? Who will lead the West African nation when President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf leaves office in October at the end of her second term? 2 million Liberians have registered to vote, and nearly half of those are women. What's at stake in Liberia? On the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.